Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Overthrows podcast. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at DefMango on Twitter. And today, we've actually got Rob Barron from Cricket 8 today, because Jared is on vacation. And we basically intend to break down England's record-shattering win in the Multan Test. But before we get into any of that, how are you doing, Robbo?
Good, thanks, mate. Yeah, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Been a busy day. I was in another podcast right before this, so I'm just glad I made it on time. And let's get right into it. So let's talk a bit about England. Of course, you know, the last time they toured, Rob, Pakistan, that is, they made a statement in that first test in Rawalpindi when they scored like more than 500 runs on day one. And that kind of set the tone for the rest of the series. And this time, I believe they've made a far bigger statement in Multan in 2024. And they didn't even have Ben Stokes and an experienced bowling attack, right? Like they had Leach and Wokes, but everyone else was super inexperienced. And every time the Baz bowlers have basically conceded 500 plus runs in the first innings, they've gone on and won those test matches. And that, I find at least, a bizarre statistic.
I mean, it sure is. England are a ridiculous cricket team, but they were playing a cricket team that's even more ridiculous. So we got a ridiculous test match. Last time, though, England had a very clear strategy of whacking everything. Hmm. It was very basic, but it worked. England came out and said they smoked, 575 overs for four on day one of a series away in Pakistan. Now, that is unprecedented. That had never happened before. England had never won two matches in a row in Pakistan before. And that series was... But it was based on an attack with the ball that was bowling dry and behaving itself. So they had very experienced guys. They had James Anderson going at two and over for the whole series. They have Mark Wood, who can we know how quick he can bowl, and so he can take the pitch out of the equation a bit. He was going at 2.5 and over. And Ollie Robinson, remember him? He was going at 2.5 and over for the whole series. They had three guys that weren't even going for 3 and over. And they had everybody with the bat just went, we're going to smoke everything, and that's that. So if the pitch is really good, we're going to smash through the line and you're going to get very tired very quickly running after it. And England destroyed Pakistan doing that, and it was brilliant and a good watch and all that. This is completely different. Yeah. And it's not based on... So when I was getting ready to moan when I was told that Jared was taking time off, which can't be allowed ever again, but when I was told that... I was getting ready to moan about how ridiculous it was that England had assembled this attack and all the reasons why they couldn't put a decent attack on the park. Yeah. But England kind of went, it doesn't matter, you can have 550 if you want. And this version of England are not even mildly bothered if someone else scores 550 in the first innings. And to be fair, 550 was a below par score on this pitch.
Yeah, I mean, that really
was a high
tells
win.
You a story, right? We'll come to the pitch. I just want to talk a bit more about the context of this game, right? Like, England created history. And as you mentioned, they didn't even have Jimmy's experience and Ollie Robinson, both of whom really, you know, were amazing at reverse swinging the ball and bending their backs in the last tour. And Mark Wood is as good a flat pitch bowler as you could ask for, right? Because he has that express pace. Without all three of those guys, plus, you know, Stuart Broad didn't tour last time, but he too has retired. Chris Wokes does not have a good away record, and he did all right. And then Brydon Carse was making his debut. I thought his lengths were good. And Matthew Potts, who I thought should have played, didn't matter in the end. And Gus Atkinson found a way in Multan as well. Add Shoaib Bashir, who did look a bit out of sorts, and Jack Leach, who ended up taking 7 wickets in this test match, by the way. 3 in the first innings and 4 for 30 in the second. That is as many wickets as Pakistan took in that entire innings, right, when they bowled England. That paints a harrowing picture that Jack Leach and Pakistan took the same amount of wickets in this test match. I mean, where do you even go with that?
Well, you just walked us through the England attack there, and on paper, it's rubbish. Right, particularly for these conditions. And not only wasn't James Anderson here because England forced him to retire, he couldn't even be bothered to turn up and be the bowling coach because he was too busy playing golf. Like, that's how mental this England team is. And they just went, okay, we know that Chris Wokes, over a long period of time and a big sample size, averages over 50 with the ball away from home. Right, so he's going to lead the attack, obviously. So he leads the attack, that's fine. Then you've got Gus Atkinson, who I didn't think would do what he did at the start of his test career. I don't think anybody did. I was just absolutely shocked. You kind of had to pick him after that. Like, fair enough. He was getting 7 wickets every innings. Fine. Not the guy for Asia away for me. Brydon Carse, didn't see him as being anywhere near the England Test team. He did all right. He did fine.
Yeah.
Shoaib Bashir is not Test match quality. I am very strong on this opinion. I think it's pretty obvious. I've watched him bowl loads of times. I would play for England if they asked me to, but I'm no good at cricket. But I think Bashir was picked on kind of fumes and because he's tall.
He's a quickness pick. The release points, of course, and that basically gives Baz and Stokes a boner. We all know this stuff, right? He's their golden quickness baby. And, you know, yeah. Somerset's number one spinner outbowled him in this game, who is England's number two spinner right now. That is very interesting. But, you know, what they've done over here, England, is that they have created history and they have absolutely deflated Pakistan. You could look at the body language of the Pakistan players. And, you know, despite the surface, and we'll come to the surface, don't worry, England still managed to take 19 wickets, which were enough because Abrar was in the hospital. And quality fine sides, like Shaan Masood mentioned in the post-match interview, they find a way. And England found a way to even, you know, force a result and win a test match on this atrocious surface, like this terrible excuse of a cricket pitch, which I think kind of speaks volumes about baseball and this team.
Yeah, I think what the England method can do is it can discombobulate the other team. And that's what happened here. You add extreme heat and having to field for ages, but it wasn't just having to field, because England had to field for the same amount of time in the first innings as Pakistan did, but Pakistan kept having to chase after twos and threes in the field, and that is really tiring.
Yep.
I mean, Abrar got way too hot, and he's, you know, he in the hospital. That's where he ended up. England kind of, Pakistan was so done by conceding 800, which was, it kind of looked like it was as soon as England decided that they weren't going to declare when they got to kind of 550, 600, 650, they were like, well, we're going to bat once and we're going to bat for absolutely ages.
Yep.
Pakistan were like, oh shit, now we're going to have to run around after the ball for another two sessions or whatever it is. And it's really hot and we're all bored and we can't get any wickets. And then you try and come out to bat and the first ball set the table. It was done. The first ball, the game was over. And a massive booming drive. Ball one. What the hell are you doing?
If you notice all the Pakistan batters in that third innings, you know, a lot of tired shots. You could see that these guys are mentally and physically toast. That was what was apparent, you know, on the screen. And, you know, just to paint a Pakistan POV on this, right? Because we've spoken about the English POV. They lost to England by an innings and 47 runs after posting 556 in the first innings. No team in the history of cricket, 147 years of Test cricket, had ever lost by an innings after posting 500 plus runs in their first innings. So that's a record on its own, right? Also, Pakistan are now 11 Test matches winless at home, which is their worst ever streak at home. They've leveled their streak of 11 winless tests at home from 1969 to 1975. But in that streak, they had one loss and 10 draws. This one is a lot worse. You're looking at four draws and seven losses, and their last win at home in a test match game versus South Africa back in Feb 2021. You and I didn't even know each other back in Feb 2021, right? That's 3.5 years ago. And it gets worse. You're looking at six back-to-back losses in Test cricket, right? Like Shaan Masood hasn't really won a Test match as captain. Six games as captain and six losses. And, you know, this, I feel now, without a doubt, is the lowest ebb in Pakistan's storied cricketing history, right? Because it is a proud cricketing nation. And you, or everyone actually, thought of this side throughout their existence, really, as a mercurial team. They get galvanized and on their way, they can take anyone down. That is yesterday's narrative now. This team is consistently poor. And as we saw in this test match, they were physically incapable, mentally incapable of, you know, clawing their way back into the contest. I don't even think they can recover from this, honestly. It's that big a dent. They'd probably need therapy or something. And it's just a ridiculous downward spiral, not just for the team, but also for the country. Like, for the longest time, Pakistan's cricket was running parallel to Pakistan, the nation. You know, but it's a country which is an economic turmoil, political turmoil, and the cricket is caught up. And it is really tragic, even from a neutral standpoint, because Pakistan cricket and West Indian cricket, those are two teams which added a lot of flavor to Test cricket. And that flavor's gone, Rob.
Yeah, I mean, firstly, it's a massive shout to say this is the lowest ebb for Pakistan. I think the main thing, so Pakistan for a long time in my lifetime were based on one very good spinner was in the team pretty much at all times. Latterly, that was Ajmal and then Yasir Shah in Test, and they had both of those at one point. But they also had Mohammad Yusuf, Yunus Khan, before that, Inzamam, they always had totally dependable test match batsmen.
Hmm.
Now, at the moment, they don't have a spinner that is anywhere near Saklain or Mushy or any of the guys that I just mentioned. They don't have anyone anywhere near that class.
Abdul Qadir is another one.
Right. Of course. So they don't have anyone in that category now, Pakistan. And they used to base a lot of their success of being good in spinny conditions, which we haven't had at all in this test, obviously. But the batting in the last 5 years, maybe a bit longer, has been based around one guy and who is dependable, particularly in easy conditions. Dependable, you're not going to get him out. Now, in the, what was it, the 11 test matches you've just spoken about, and in the last basically 2 years, Babar is in bad form in international cricket.
18. And he's not. The number stands at 18 test match innings without a 50-plus score. Forget 50-plus score. He hasn't scored 40 in those 18 innings,
yeah,
right?
It's unacceptable. He's on thin
ice. Yeah.
It's unacceptable for a guy that is that good at cricket. And it wasn't that long ago that everyone was talking about him being in the same category as Root and Kohli and Steve Smith. And Babar, in my head, Babar's never been as good at test as he is at ODIs. I think the tempo of ODI where he can just bat through and everybody else can try and, you know, pick up the rate at the end or whatever. But it's a big problem for Pakistan because they look to him as being the guy that's going to be in at the other end and he keeps getting out very cheaply. And that has a knock-on effect to the whole of the batting lineup by the looks of it. I mean, England were similar for a while. I mean, they had Stokes to back Root up for a fair bit. But when Root failed, England often collapsed. That happened a lot. But now Pakistan are kind of like, well, if Babar can't score, none of us are going to. And they need somebody or a couple of them to step up a bit. And you could argue that the first innings, you'd think, well, Shah Masood is the sort of guy that can bat time. He can play sensible long innings. He has the technique for that. And anything that you thought was good about Pakistan's batting, you can throw on the fire because of what happened in the second innings. On an absolute road, they just threw a test match away. They didn't even try and defend and block and anything. There's loads of records and statistics which everybody has been rattling off in the last few days about this test match. The thing that appalls me the most about this test match, and I prefer to be appalled than celebrate anything, so I am appalled at Pakistan scoring at 4 and over in that last innings. What are you doing scoring at 4 and over, whacking the ball around, playing expansive shots? You shouldn't be caught unless you've nicked off to a ball that seamed away or moved. You should not be caught in that innings. You can be out LBW. You can't really be out bowled because you should be covering your stumps up. It should be the wickets that happen should be LBW to spinners when you're in full block mode. You cannot be caught at cover. You can't be caught at long on, and you can't be stumped running down the pitch. So the biggest disgrace of this, yes, anybody can get done on a good pitch when two bats of the class of Brook and Root get in together. We've seen that in test matches right down the years. You know, I remember doing the Sangakkara Jayawardena partnership where they were just never going to get out. They were never going to get out.
Yeah.
That can happen. But then you have to have in your head as a batting unit while you are being physically drained in the field, you have to go, right, lads, this is still a road. There's still a test match draw up for grabs here. But I don't think Pakistan even thought about that.
No, absolutely not. I mean, to your point, right? They just had to bat for 4 and a quarter sessions, right? To save the test match. And at that point, that's what they should have been thinking about, just to bat it out, right? Bat time and just not lose this game. But, you know, third innings collapses aren't new to Pakistan cricket. They've kind of been the norm, actually, in recent times. They've set a trend over here. In this year alone, you know, third innings in Sydney, after they'd scored like 300-plus in the first innings, they were all out for 115. Lost that test match in Australia. Then very recently versus Bangladesh, they had 2 third innings and 2 collapses, right? One time they scored 172 and the next they scored 146. This time they scored 220, which is actually a step up, but it's still a third innings collapse because they were, what, 41 for 4 or something like that. And to your point, like the manner in which they were getting out, it was just like, this is test cricket, boys. You've got to fight it out. Sure, you've been completely butchered by England, but show some character. Save this test match and at least, you know, save some blemishes. And now they'll obviously, you know, get criticized the crap out of them because they honestly, frankly, deserve it too, because that just wasn't a test match performance at all. Like, if this was not Pakistan and some other nation which was very recently an associate nation, right? For instance, take Afghanistan or Ireland. People would be questioning their test status at this point. That's how bad Pakistan were. And you mentioned the batting, right? Of course, there were some good things. We saw the first innings and you all of a sudden thought that this might be some promising stuff from Pakistan. Abdullah Shafiq, who had been in a ridiculous run of form, scored 102. But come second innings, that lazy shot on the first ball, getting his off stump, like sent for a vacation by Chris Wokes, right? That's been his entire career. High scores and terrible failures. He is a standard deviation king in that regard. You look at Syam Ayoob, he scored, 4-25? And that might just be the worst shot I have seen in a long time, the one he got out to in the second innings. Like, what are you really trying to achieve over here? That was just horrendous, right? Shaan Masood, I was so thrilled for him, actually, when he scored 151 in the first innings, because I know him a bit, right? Not a lot, but a bit. There's a personal relationship there. And I was over the moon for him because he was ruthless against spin, particularly versus Shoaib Bashir. And he has this thing where he's actually really good versus off spin, which is rare for a left-handed bat. So he was ruthless against spin and he was covered driving to perfection. And it was his highest score in Test cricket since August 2020. You remember that COVID series in England where he scored like a 150 or something?
God, yeah. We all stood up and took notice of Masood in that series, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was the last time he scored a Test ton and this was his highest score since. And it's been 15 Test matches since then, right? He's just now averaging above 30 again in Test cricket. And look, I liked a lot in that innings. Like, there was so much to love, especially the fact that he was kind of playing England's game. He was baz-balling it, 50 of 43, 100 of 102. And even in the end, his 151 was like at a strike rate of 85. Love all of that, right? Sure, he started to cramp. And maybe he should have probably, you know, he should be taking notes from Joe Root, who was also cramping. But Shaan Masood was clearly undone by his cramps. I think that dismissal, cramps had a huge part to play in that dismissal, right? But when you look at the second innings dismissal, like, you've been dropped twice. Sure, there were tough chances, one-handed drops, right, by Wokes and Atkinson. But then you're literally, like, giving England catching practice. It was an appalling dismissal on 11 when you were the captain and you know that you have to save this test match.
Yeah, so exactly.
He doesn't get a passing grade because of that. I still feel that way, right? Babar Azam, we've mentioned, you know, a batter of his caliber has gone 18 test innings without a 50-plus score or 40-plus score. And, you know, his dismissals were really poor. He got worked out by Chris Wokes in the first one. Got his outside edge was beaten right before his dismissal. Then he walks across his stumps and the ball slightly jags back in and he's LBW, right? That was poor. Second dismissal, his dismissal in the third innings, they made a comparison on TV. I think Nasser Hussain was talking about this, that Root, when he plays that shot, how his back leg is kind of, you know, in balance, and Babar's back leg was all over the place. So those are technical issues that Babar needs to address. And I understand that he's mentally toast at this point, but there are a lot of technical issues that need to be looked at over here. So these are big concerns for Pakistan. You look at Saud Shakeel, 82 and 29, fine. You got out to spin, dude, twice. You're supposed to be excellent versus spin. That is unacceptable. Rizwan made 10 runs in two innings, including a duck. I can excuse that because he's generally the guy who's always fighting it out. So he perhaps gets a pass. And then Salman Ali Aga was probably the only guy who kind of stood up and, you know, put his hand up. He was like, all right, I'm going to kind of fight it out over here. Scored an unbeaten 104 and 63. Can't really fault him. Even took Root's wicket. And then Ahmed Jamal, out of all people, scored an unbeaten 55. So, you know, the guys who you expect to kind of raise their hand and take responsibility have gone missing. And Pakistan cannot pick up a bat in the third innings. And, you know, if you at least bat well, you can save games. But you lose games because you're getting out. You're not winning games because you can't get people out. There's just so much wrong with this team.
You want to swing wildly at the internet like you've got the new pill in your hand, but you keep getting dead-batted. Find the movement you want with NordVPN. They are our protection against terrifying cyber threats and wide-batted geo-blocks. NordVPN will help you get through any rights restrictions so you can watch all the cricket you want. We aren't always happy with the wickets we're on. Sometimes we need a change. NordVPN can switch your virtual location so your IP address is ready to cash in. So if you need to get around the internet's rules, or I suppose in our case, laws, select NordVPN. They can help you watch a game on a cheaper stream in another country. Give NordVPN the ball and let them penetrate all your vast internet issues. Because if you need a VPN, go Nord. Use nordvpn.com/Kimber to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan, plus 4 additional months for free. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. You can also receive a 20 gigabyte daily data voucher. The link is in the show notes. Protect your computer like a big hitter is coming for you at nordvpn.com/KIMBER right now.
Yeah, I think the captain has to shoulder a lot of the blame there, though, for this loss. I think the cap and when the guy scored 150 in the first innings, you think, right, he's back. He's in good form. This is a good deck. He can lead this attack now, because when Babar is having a very, like, quite a long lean trot now, like, Babar is, as you say, he's got technical deficiencies. It's not like one of those spells that any batsman can get where he's been unlucky or he's nicked off or he's got run out or he got a really good one early. This isn't happening. Babar is getting out to balls that he would easily defend or even score off in the past. Now they're getting him out. So Masood has to step up there, right?
Yeah.
And when he's just seen Shafiq, who, as you say, is a feast or famine kind of batsman, play a stupid shot, Shan has got to come in at number three and go, right, guys, this is what you do now. Forward defence, leave. There are shots. That's what we do now because we're trying to save a test match. We cannot possibly, it's physically impossible, mathematically impossible for us to win this test match. So let's not even think about that as an option. So attacking shots get us nothing. Unless you're trying to manoeuvre the field when you've been in for a certain amount of time and you all that kind of stuff. That was never a consideration. So it's up to him to come in and set the tone for his team. And that second innings kind of destroyed the 150 they got in the first innings. It was a completely different cricketer. He got dropped. He got dropped and then he got out.
I don't think
really stupid shot.
I don't think he gets a passing grade, right? Just because of that stupid shot and the way he was playing in the second innings. Because if there are two players in Pakistan who I'm like, okay, these guys did all right. Salman Ali Agha and Amir Jamal. I'm not going to fault those guys. Amir Jamal even took that worldie of a catch, right? To dismiss Ollie Pope.
Yeah, yeah.
So those guys had positive outputs. His figures don't reflect it, but I think he was like really putting in a lot when he was bowling as well. He was bowling his heart out. And you spoke about Shan and how he needed to shoulder that responsibility. Some of the decision-making as captain was also atrocious, right? Do you remember the negative lines that Abrar was bowling? They were bowling outside leg stump to Harry Brook and Joe Root. You're coming at the end of the game and saying that quality sides find a way to take 20 wickets. Well, I'm sorry, Shan, but you can't take wickets if you're bowling outside the leg stump to two batters who are on the top of their game, right? What are you waiting for them to balloon one, you know, trying to sweep a top edge perhaps? Like, that is an inherently flawed plan. It is not attacking cricket. So you can't come on and say that, oh, you know, we've got to find a way to take 20 wickets. Well, you're not going to take very many in that way. It's just a very, very flawed plan. Then, I don't know if you remember this, but he took the second new ball like 5.2 overs late, as if there was something that Pakistan were, you know, kind of doing with the old ball. They weren't getting any purchase with the old ball either. So why are you waiting for 5.2 overs? I think Nasim Shah was overbowled. He bowled 31 overs and towards the end of England's innings, I have no clue why Nasim was bowling. Like, do you want to break him, right? This is an injury-prone bowler. We know he just came back. Do you want to run him to the ground? Why is he bowling these dog overs when England will declare any minute? Just give them to Shan Masood, Salman Ali Agha. And the bottom line really is that he's captained in 6 test matches and lost 6 test matches, which is a record, right? So his position is under threat right now. There are rumors in Pakistan that he might be removed, strong rumors, but that's not going to fix anything. The captaincy, as, you know, dodgy it was as it was in this test match, I don't think that's the reason why Pakistan is shit. There are far more complex reasons behind that. And it has to do with administration, the volatility and instability in the board. There is a fair bit of mediocrity and incompetence at play. There's no continuity in domestic structures. You don't know how to manage injuries. You don't know how to manage workloads. And I mean, this probably doesn't even cut it. There are things that I'm probably forgetting right now. So a captaincy change won't fix it. There are no easy fixes to this, Rob. There are no stopgap solutions. You will need a structure. You will need process. And that seems to be, or Pakistan cricket seems to be forever deprived of that structure and process. That's the grave reality.
But none of that stuff is new for Pakistan. Like, the board's always changing and they're saying, right, these guys are going to be mentors and Sarfaraz is going to tell you how to behave yourselves. You know, all this sort of complete nonsense where you can have a guy who is installed, sacked and reinstalled as captain without a game taking place. Like, it's only Pakistan that does that. Like, like the real clown stuff. But yeah, you're right. You're right. The Shah Masood captaincy does need a look as well, because the one thing, you can say whatever you want about England, and they do loads of stupid stuff, and I'll happily talk about that whenever you want, but they always try and take wickets. This team always tries to take wickets. And when conditions aren't in their favour, they think about it and they go, okay, let's try this for half an hour. We're going to bowl short. Or let's try this. We're going to bowl outside off and we're going to set this field just to see if they fall into the trap. We're going to keep trying and we're going to keep trying to take wickets. We're going to give you the drive. If you hit a cover drive for four, it's yours. We're not going to plug that gap all day. You can have it.
Speaking of wickets, sorry, I'm interjecting over here, but do you remember when England came out to bat? Nasim and Shaheen were actually bowling pretty well with the new ball. That first eight overs were, you know, that was a really fantastic spell by both. He took them off. I understand that you want to give your premier bowlers short bursts, not to break them, but ultimately you've overbowled Nasim. And when the ball was actually doing something, when Shaheen finally found his length and was challenging Zach Crawley's outside edge, you take those guys off. You give them one more over at least over there.
Yeah, because wickets are at such a premium. It wasn't like... It wasn't like a great big secret that the pitch was amazing. So when you've got a chance as bowlers, you must go for the throat, right? You must take it, which he didn't do. And the point you make about over bowling is, I mean, England know about that. You know, Jofra Archer's not here, is he?
Yep.
England know about over bowling people when he bowled 40-something overs against New Zealand in a drawn test match. That was so dumb from England, and they cost themselves possibly the best thing that could have happened to their bowling attack for 30 years, a fit Jofra Archer, the guy that we saw come onto the scene 6 years ago. So we don't have him anymore because he got overbowled. Now, Pakistan, we've seen with Shaheen already that his speeds are down. He's not quite the same guy as he was pre-injury because he had to play in every single game for every single format for Pakistan, plus captaining franchise teams, plus suddenly becoming a bit of a bat as well. He's like, can you just do everything? And the guy's 21. When they're asking him to do all this stuff, he's going to break, right? Big, tall, fast bowlers that are on planes every other day playing in different matches. If you don't look after them, you ruin them, right? And they've already seen this with Nasim, who the last tour, what, how many of the Pakistan, Harris Rauf was playing in it? How many of the Pakistan...
13 overs Harris Rauf in the Pindi test before he broke down as well, remember?
Right.
And Shaheen was rushed back from injury, so they never rehabilitated him properly, which is why the speeds are down. You don't see that same kind of lateral movement anymore. And first he used to pitch it up and you were like, okay, guaranteed new ball wickets. Now he pitches it up. He's driven almost every single time for four, right? We saw this in this very test match.
Yeah, and he was, only about 18 months ago, the number one opening bowler in the world. Like, frightening movement, as you say, early wickets, fully expected. But they're not learning from their mistakes, Pakistan, because there is, as you rightly point out there, Bayram, there's no chance whatsoever that Nasim should be bowling when all Pakistan are now doing is waiting to bat, right?
Exactly.
They can't win, so bowl underarm. That's when you start bowling leg side, right, to stop them scoring so fast. You try and slow the game down because you need to take time out of the game for yourselves. So you can't just bowl underarm and get and let them hit you for six every ball. But that's when you start all the negative stuff, not five sessions before that. And England, so this is the big difference from England's last tour to this one, is they actually showed some semblance of thinking about it with the bat because Pakistan said, we don't really want to be hit for boundaries here. And Brook and Root went, all right, then ones and twos. And they just did, and the fitness is a big issue. And they went, okay, ones and twos. And they scored ones and twos for about a day. And Pakistan had no answer to this. And Root did cramp. And when he was on about 100, bear in mind, he got 250 or something. When he was on about 100, Root looked like he was completely knackered and he was cramping and he got to 100, he played left-handed,
juice.
Didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
He played a left-handed shot when he was on 100 and I think someone must have said to him, do you remember last time you did that, Joe, against New Zealand, you got out? Right, stop doing that. And then whatever happened, they showed real sense, which is not something you ever associate with England. They went, okay, yes, we've got cramp now. We're going to try and get to the next break and take on more fluids and do whatever they do, eat the energy bars and the gels and whatever else. But they calmed down again. They didn't go, we've got 100, so we're going to reverse sweep, we're going to scoop, we're going to ramp, we're going to run down the pitch. They for 10 minutes, I thought England were going to do that and then end up somewhere near Pakistan's score. And then, you know, then it's a very different test match. But I don't know whether someone spoke to them or they worked it out between themselves, if we just chill out here and take all these very easy singles, we can score as many as we want because we're never going to get out. And so England outthought Pakistan. And if you're getting outthought by this England team, you are in big trouble because they ain't the sharpest.
Rob, we could probably outthink Pakistan at this point, right? and which brings me to the surface, right? Because I think you are signing a death wish if you are preparing a flat deck to face England and this particular England, Stokes' Baz bowlers.
Yeah.
He wasn't even playing this test match, right? He probably doesn't want to play the next one because they didn't need him. And why would he want to bowl here? He's just coming back from injury. That's the harrowing bit. And just on the surface, though, I'll give you some context. 2 to 3 days before, I saw some tweets come out from proper, you know, journalists within the industry in Pakistan saying that, oh, it's a green top. And I, who has been on like four different shows at that point, including the TalkSport one, am saying everywhere that, look, it's not even possible. You cannot produce a green top in Multan at this time of year. It's like blistering hot. And even if it looks green right now, they'll give it a trim. And even if there is some purchase for the bowlers in the first or even second session, which is me being generous, it will flatten out. So you do not want to face this English team on a flat deck. Maybe a sticky surface, a slow sticky surface, and then tell them, okay, go ahead and hit us now. This was just like, how can you even expect to outbat England on a flat deck? And, you know, when the test match started, my early thoughts were, all right, you know, maybe they are trying to produce a UAE-esque surface because we could see some cracks in the close-up. And I was thinking, all right, you know what? Let's just give it some time. Let's talk on day three. Let's see if there is any deterioration. Let's see how this pitch evolves across, you know, all the different days. But when you came to day three, that surface was so rock hard that it looked like a day one pitch. There was no wear and tear. There were no footmarks. 2 wickets fell on the entire day. On day three, right? That's like the state of deterioration. There was none. It was an absolute highway, like the autobahn, or maybe a runway. I would be keen on running off or taking off a plane from that surface, right? And, you know, sure, we got a result. And England managed to find, you know, 19 wickets to win the test match. But this makes for dull cricket. And you're going to kill test cricket in Pakistan if you continue to make these surfaces. Jason Gillespie and Shaan Masood said that, oh, we expected the surface to behave this way. We just couldn't take the wickets. Why are you preparing this sort of surface? That's not on Tony Hemming if you're asking him for that. You prepare a flat deck against, you know, Stokes's Baz bowlers, and, you know, you should do that at your own peril, because if they have learned absolutely anything from the last time England toured Pakistan, it should have been that don't prepare a flat deck versus this team. They went ahead and did that. Like you said, that 550 was under par. Well, 450 was definitely under par. And I feel like if you have a test match surface in which 450 runs are not enough, then it is an unfit surface for test cricket. It's not a test match at that point. It is a weight loss boot camp, right? You're just asking people to come along and lose some kilos. And I actually have a question for you. Does it even make sense to bat first on this sort of surface? Because then the team batting second will come and outbat you potentially and put you under pressure in the third innings. And you are then in a situation where you cannot win the test match anymore and you're under pressure. So perhaps batting second is the better ploy over here.
Very interesting shout that. I think the only way I would think about that is because you're doing more things that England don't really want you to do. England love dictating from batting second and last. England love chasing. England go, right, there are times when England go, oh, fine, you're going to get loads in the third innings. That's a shame. We're going to have to score quicker in our fourth innings. Simple as that. Like, we're going to have to gun down whatever you've set us. And if Pakistan had found a way to have a big lead in this, England would have tried to knock the runs off. There's no question about that. But your original point about the pitch is home advantage should be a big thing in cricket, and particularly between the Asian countries and the non-Asian countries, because when Bangladesh play T20s at home at places like Mirpur, the ball grubs along the floor and spins sideways.
Yes.
And Australia come over, and Australia are much better than Bangladesh at T20 cricket. They get walloped in the T20s because they don't know how to play on those pitches, and all the Bangladesh players do. So you can use home advantage to win new games, and Bangladesh have been doing that in white ball stuff for a long time now. They've also been, as Pakistan will tell you, wildly improving in test matches, Bangladesh. That said, it's very obvious that you don't want to play against England on a road.
Yep.
It's up to Pakistan. Pakistan are allowed to create pitches which suit their style of play.
I don't think they know how to. I think that's where the problem is. I don't even think they know what pitches suit them. right? I was in favor of a sticky surface. I was like, okay, England will struggle to hit the ball off the square, and they will, obviously, knowing the Bass bowlers, will try to attack. That was the ploy, in my head at least. Because you can't produce a green top over here, and England seamers come into the game if you do produce a green top. So that is also inherently flawed.
Just poor planning and thinking from Pakistan. Now, if they literally can't make this one, bear in mind the other venue in this series is Rawalpindi, and that has been as roady as you get in
well,
world
recently,
cricket.
Though, in that second test versus Bangladesh, we've seen some promise. That was a far better surface. So hopefully we get something.
Because it deteriorated. And that's kind of what Pakistan were banking on here. But when you give away a 300 run deficit in the first innings, like, that's gone as well. So it's very difficult to find positives here for Pakistan. But yeah. if we'd have spoken on day two of this test match, I'd have been vehemently moaning about how stupid England are by assembling that, you know, in inverted commas, attack for Asian conditions. The bowling coach is on the golf course. Nobody's fit that's any good. And like, we've got Chris Wokes leading the attack and Bashir is our second spinner. Like, I'm confused now about Jack Leach, because Pakistan make me think that Jack Leach might actually be quite good. And I've never thought that before. Like, he doesn't, you know, he's a bit like an early Nathan Lyon, who just sort of lands it in the right place. And Lyon went on to really work out cricket because I think he's got a good cricket brain. I've never thought that Leach was particularly good. He shouldn't be taking 7 wickets on pitches like that. He shouldn't be taking more than the entire Pakistan team in a test match like that on that deck. But he did. I mean, Bashir didn't do anything. But if Jack Leach is looking good, again, it's more worries for Pakistan. And the other thing that Pakistan have got is now that they, on paper, Nasim Shah and Shaheen is a gun couple of bowlers to be in tandem against you, right? On paper. It didn't look like it here.
Yeah.
Who comes in for Pakistan? Who's waiting here to change everything? Because it'd be a surprise if Abrar plays in a few days' time.
No, I doubt it. I don't think he'll be able to play that second test match. Someone even in the comments said that he might have dengue fever. I'm not sure about that, but like, something obviously is up with Abrar, and it's unfortunate with him. He probably didn't want to bowl those negative lines, right? That plan comes from your captain and management. And he's just dropped off, and there are multiple reasons for that. A, he's a finger spinner, essentially, even though he's like a leg spinner, but he's a finger spinner. You can't call him a wrist spinner, for instance. But he might have been found out. Another angle is that he hasn't really played any cricket because Pakistan keep warming the bench with him. So he hasn't had any game time. He's also been injured a lot, and he broke down literally in this test match. So here's a guy who everyone thought could lead Pakistan's spin bowling attack for years to come in an era where Pakistan have no spinners. There is a serious dearth of spinners. So yeah, I mean, it's all quite gloomy for Pakistan cricket, really. And you know, another thing that was funny was that the outfield was quite shitty. So you had to run more. And that doesn't help when it comes to fatigue either. And that's something you can definitely fix. Like, did you notice how some of the fielders, when they would dive, they were like heaps of dust that would come up?
Yeah,
so what's up with that? Like, you've got time to prepare this ground. It shouldn't be this way. At least, you know, in terms of batters running singles and fielders running towards the balls. You want to minimize that sort of fatigue, if anything. Because Pakistan, like you said, like, they don't even have the luxury of resting Shaheen and Naseem in test cricket. Even though right now you can make a case that they aren't even, like, at least Shaheen doesn't even probably deserve a spot. There is a lot wrong, and we will get into more of all of this after a short break. You are watching Overthrows with Behram and Rob, and we'll be back in a moment.
Thanks to NVPlay for their in-depth performance analysis on this project. You can find out more about them on their website.
Welcome back to the Overthrows podcast. You guys are with Behram and Rob. And before we get back into the serious stuff, Rob, I don't know if you appreciated the Multan DJ in this game, because there were a lot of Adele tracks. The DJ literally set fire to the rain like 20 times. You saw Dream On being played, which is apt for Pakistan. And then there was a point where Believer was played by Imagine Dragons. And I mean, if anything, all the pain will make unbelievers out of people, because there's not much to believe, in that team. And the crowds were also like, first day was decent. You know, you saw some people come in. Second day, it reduced. And days 3, 4 and 5, it was just a smattering of some Barmy Army folks, which was pretty much it. And why would they even come to watch this sort of cricket, right?
Yeah, it's disappointing. That's one thing that you definitely don't want to see is just loads and loads of empty seats when you're watching a test match. And then the job of the DJ becomes all the more important when there's nobody there, I guess. I think we should probably do a podcast on cricketing DJs. The one that immediately springs to mind is the 80-year-old woman that does it in the Big Bash. She's really funny when she's on the Wheels of Steel. That is an interesting one. I think you could have a lot of fun in that job with choosing your songs.
I know, but there's one at the Ekana Stadium in Lucknow. That DJ is also lit. Always like plays bangers from Bollywood from the 90s. And I love that because I haven't really watched Bollywood in the last 20 years, so I only know those songs. So it's a fun DJ over there as well. But yeah, I don't know if you caught the charging station. You know, usually you just see a bunch of people having some Tapal tea, but this time they had a charging station, which was solar powered. So the marketing people were all right, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I missed... We managed to have David Gower back on the main feed, which is always a good thing. But him talking about his very passive-aggressive chat whenever he has to advertise the Tapal tea is usually really good. That's something to look out for in the PSL when he has to advertise stuff.
Yeah.
But the fact that we're talking about this, we're trying to find basically people from anywhere near the Pakistan team that come out of this test match with any credit. And we've got the DJ and the charging station marketing people and like none of the, like the groundsman's, he's in the bin, the team's in the bin, the star's in the bin. It's like, the DJ did quite good and we like the guy that did the, do you know what I mean? It's like, this is clutching at straws, Bayram, isn't it?
It really
not
is.
Not a good test.
Yeah. We'll come to Pakistan's bowling in a bit, but I think the gulf between both teams as batting sides needs to be discussed over here. Of course, if you're losing by an innings, then clearly you couldn't score as many runs as the opposition did in one innings, right? You couldn't outbat them in two innings combined. And Pakistan scored 556 runs in 149 overs, which isn't the worst thing in the world. I'm going to repeat that. I don't think the scoring rate was as big of an issue. But when you compare that to England, at the 149 over mark, they were 815 for 7, and they declared an over later at 823 for 7 in 150 overs. So they played one more over and scored 267 more runs. And that, I feel, is like, I don't know, man. It really speaks volumes of the ability of this side to score at quick rates. Like, I don't know if you've seen the little graphic that Varun has made for Jared, and it's up on his socials, where there are all the test innings in the history of test cricket, you know, on his same scatter plot. And the x-axis has runs, and the y-axis has runs per over. And this 823 at 5.5 stands as an absolute outlier. And the India one versus Bangladesh, in which they went at like 9 and over, is also an outlier at the extreme right. And those two test matches are 10 days apart. So cricket is changing, you know?
Massively. And a lot of the records that are tumbling, it's like, well, this... England did that a year ago, and England did that 2 years ago. And the India one was very interesting. The question there is, does that test match happen in that way? Do we get a result in that test if England weren't playing like they've been playing for the last few years? Yeah. I don't know. But it sounds like, when you put it like that, that they batted for basically the same amount of time and England scored boatloads more runs, it sounds like England were whacking it. But England weren't whacking it. England scored, what, 5 sixes in 800 and something runs?
And this three of them were scored by Harry Brook, right?
Yeah. Smacking the spinner straight from memory. Pakistan got loads more sixes than England did, right? How is that possible? How is that possible? Pakistan scored at 3.7 and over, and England scored at 5.5 and over, and Pakistan hit, I'm just adding them up in my head, so give us 15 minutes. They hit 11 sixes, right, Pakistan, and England hit 5. That's impossible, right? Yeah. That is impossible. England scored 800 and Pakistan scored 550. And Pakistan scored double the amount of sixes. That is not possible. That is the most surprising statistic out of all of this. So wasn't that England just...
Yeah.
Pakistan weren't fit enough, I think, was some of it. And they weren't hungry enough in the first innings, because I think cricketers are programmed now to think that 500 runs is loads. And when people got that 100 is loads in a test match, and when the Pakistani batsmen got to 100, all right, Shafiq got an okay ball from Atkinson, maybe you could argue that. We got out for basically 100. Nobody had the desire there, I don't think, in the first innings, or nobody really thought that 550 wasn't enough. They batted as if that was loads, and that's fine and good luck. From the betting market point of view, though, you can say that there's a huge gap between the sides. England were 14 to 1 to win this test match at one point. 14 to 1 to win the test match.
Wow.
Which is like, what, a 6.6% chance to win the game. So it looked like for quite a while, only a few days ago, it looked like Pakistan were bossing this test match. And when Pope gets caught at, what was that, short mid wicket early, unbelievable catch from somebody who did come out of this test match with a lot of credit for Pakistan.
Yeah, yeah. That was the catch of the game, 100%.
Yeah, yeah, it was a great catch. I mean, considering some of the drops that we saw, bloody hell.
Yeah.
Some,
absolutely appalling. Can we take a minute to kind of just, you know, talk about all the lapses in the field? Because Pakistan had those two very obvious ones, right? Where Babar dropped Joe Root at mid wicket. Right, which I don't understand why Amir Jamal wasn't there, right? Because if he's taken that worldly, you keep him there. And then Saud Shakeel also had a very poor drop shortly after. But if you look at England, I mean, Rob, I don't think England have ever fielded this poorly in an innings victory before, right? Ollie Pope alone, early on in the game, missed that Abdullah Shafiq run out, which really should have been run out.
Yeah, yeah.
Then he dropped Shaan Masood in the 130s. In the second innings, he dropped a one-handed catch in Gully, which is fine. Okay, I can excuse that. But then he drops Amir Jamal on day five as well. This doesn't even scratch the surface, right? Shoaib Bashir drops Amir Jamal end of day four. Chris Wokes and Atkinson both drop one-handed catches of Shaan Masood off each other's bowling. Jamie Smith misses a stumping, which was comical. Gus Atkinson drops a dolly. Chris Wokes nearly pulls off a world-class parried catch, which is a six instead. Like, how have they managed to win by an innings and 47 runs despite all of these lapses in the field? It blows my mind.
Bear in mind, right, we're not talking about a minefield where it's spitting like a cobra or it's seeming all over the place where chances are going to happen all the time. This is a pitch where if you're batting sensibly, you should not be giving any chances.
Yeah.
And for over a day, two people showed you that you don't give any chances if you're just behaving yourself. And we're saying there's 9 drop catches in the test match. Some of them my 7-year-old daughter would have taken, and she's not a great fielder. Like the Bashir one was like, my God, that was bad. The Wokes one was Ben Stokes' fault, even though he wasn't there, because all Wokes had to do was stand in the right place and he would have caught it on his chest. Instead, he ran in 15 yards and then back 15 yards and tried to do a Ben Stokes,
well,
actually.
You mean Ollie Pope's fault, no? Because he would have told Wokes that you can stand.
No, it's Ben Stokes' fault, because when Ben Stokes took that catch against Pakistan in the World Cup in 2019 that everyone went on about as being the best catch ever.
South Africa.
Was that against South Africa?
Yes, it was the tournament opener where Nasser Hussain was like, you cannot do that or something like that.
Yes,
right?
Yes, you're right. Sorry, you're right. That was because Ben Stokes was stood in the wrong place. That's why that catch happened. And he had to run backwards. Rather than take an easy catch, he took a worldie because he was stood in the wrong place. And that's what Wokes tried to do.
I know I'm digressing, but there's actually a catch by Jadeja versus New Zealand in a test match that is better than that Ben Stokes catch. You guys can go find the YouTube video.
Yeah,
Ben Stokes is
the best marketed sportsman of all time. That wasn't the best catch of that World Cup, let alone the best catch ever. Go and watch Guptill's catch to get rid of Steve Smith in one of the games where he's like a silly point or something. It just takes an absolute unbelievable one-hander. I know we probably shouldn't be talking about catches 5 years ago right now, but I think, who was it? Was it Cottrell took an absolute stunner on the fence in that World Cup as well. They had absolutely no right to get to and took it one-handed and just carried on running around the fence. Anyway, yeah, Ben Stokes' catch wasn't very good. If he'd have stood in the right place, it would have been easy. But I'm saying it's his fault that Wokes was stood in the wrong place and tried to take a much more spectacular catch, because that's what he does to people. Yeah. But
also,
go on, mate.
No. Complete your
thought. Just to summarise, the catching in that test match, it's another surprising thing about it that there were that many chances, but it was appalling. It was proper bad from both teams, like really crap.
And then, of course, there was that LBW shout, Naseem versus Root, which 9 out of 10 umpires would have raised their finger, especially on that track. But Kumar Dharmasena had other ideas, and you could really feel for Naseem in that moment, because later on, it was on his bowling again that Babar dropped that dolly, you know, off Joe Root. So, you know, Nasim probably deserved Root's wicket and didn't get it, even though Root has like crossed 150 by then. So it's not like it was a chancy knock. It was already chanceless at that point. But yeah, did you catch some of the tweets in which people took the absolute piss out of Ollie Pope for A, missing those opportunities and then scoring a duck in that scorecard, basically, which looks really funny because, you know, you've got Crawley and Duckett with 78 and 85 as well, who, by the way, I think are at the forefront of baseball's success. Those two guys are really, really important. But Pope's duck was made a lot of, like, people were literally, like, making a lot of fun of him. There were memes. And, I mean, it's an interesting life when you're Ollie Pope because his place is secure. He's stand-in captain because there's no one else. And he didn't really... He contributed in the negative in this test match, didn't he?
He did, yeah. He's played 50 test matches now, Ollie Pope. And, you know, Jared said the other day that he's played the same test match 50 times. I don't know whether he justifies his place in the side as a as an out-and-out bat myself. He's not as good at catching as he should be. I think he had a very good last day, but me and you would have had a very good last day if we were captaining any attack against that Pakistan team. So I'm not going to give him his captaincy any credit. I don't think he's there as a captain. And you can say he's a young guy and he doesn't have captaincy experience. He's played 50 test matches and most of them under Ben Stokes. He can watch stuff and learn things. And, you know, if someone made me or you captain of a test match team tomorrow, we'd make some funny decisions. We'd be thinking about it. He doesn't look like he's that. He's very much, he's like a better Shah Masood in that when he feasts, he really does feast. But he has a lot of low scores as well. He's got a problem... a technical issue, which means he gets bowled a lot. He's vulnerable to good balls on his stumps. I'm not sure whether Ollie Pope is the answer, but when you've scored 800, no one cares about any particular batsman. It is funny. I mean, and you know, fair play to the internet for taking the piss out of him afterwards. But test matches, right, have changed so much now. There was a time that if your team was 550 behind, and it's not in the too distant past, where if you were 550 behind and you absolutely welted, what was it, his first ball, his second ball, your second ball, and you were caught mid-wicket by trying to smash it in the air through mid-wicket, you'd have got absolutely panned for that. Not panned for being the only one that doesn't score in the 800s. Like, what the hell are you doing? But test match cricket has changed so much. And we, Jared and I did a podcast, I think after day one of this, and I said, which has come to fruition again now, cricketers don't have the mindset at all or the technique to be able to block a draw. It's gone. Like, no one does it. When was the last time somebody did it? It used to be 50-50 if a team needed to bowl a team out in the last on the last day, roughly speaking. 10 wickets was about 50%. And you'd go, right, who's the guy that's going to stand up? Who's going to bat with him? You needed to be bloody-minded, technically proficient with defence, and put attacking shots away. You go, right, they can't dismiss us caught in these four fielding positions. It can't happen because we're not going to hit the ball in the air. So that's done. This is how we do it. We leave everything. If they want to bowl negatively, brilliant. We'll just kick it away. Great, great, great. Doesn't happen anymore. It's gone. It's gone from the game. And I think England are kind of responsible for that.
I agree.
Also, the fact that people are being bought up now on limited overs shots. So we are now seeing cricketers for the first time that when they were young, they were taught reverse sweep, switch hit, range hitting, belting the ball, right? Rather than what everybody taught everyone 20 years ago, which is block it, defend, you must have a high elbow, play
put
forward,
a price on
shot,
your wicket, all of that. Put cricket. Now it's just
now,
very, very rogue.
England are literally saying, if you play like that, you can't get in our team. It's not going to happen. It's no good for us. And so we all know that Stokes can block it out for a day. And Stokes kind of needs to block it out for 2 hours before he can whack it, really, which is why he's a crap T20 player. But that has gone out of the game. England haven't just changed the game in that they've made it more interesting from teams targeting victories from places where they never did before, see India a couple of weeks ago. They've now changed it so that no one can ever play for the draw again. And until somebody does, that is so out of fashion now. And the fact that Pope's dismissal, yes, it's funny that he was the only one that didn't score out of 800. But Pope's dismissal was just, everybody said at the time, that was unlucky. What? It was his second ball. You're 550 behind. Why is the ball in the air? Have a look for a bit. And he just went, no, I'm smoking that because that's what we do. We are that team.
You can credit that wicket to the catch, really, because it was phenomenal. But, you know, overall, I think England have, in this second iteration of baseball, kind of, you know, calm down a bit as well, because there are phases in the game where I remember Pakistan was bowling these negative lines and Ramiz Raja pointed out that, sure, you've stopped the boundaries, but they're still going at four and over. And people always say that, oh, you know, Sehwag used to baz ball or Viv Richards used to baz ball. Look, that was one player in a team. And you can make a case for Australia who were going at four and over in their golden run, but this is a team which does this en masse, which is why it's different and which is why I feel like baz ball is having an impact on cricket. And I mean, look, they went on to score the fourth highest total in Test cricket ever in this Test match, right? 823. It's also the fourth score of 800 plus in Test cricket and the highest score in the 21st century. There has been no 800 plus score in the 21st century. Fourth highest score in history, obviously. And that partnership, 454 runs between Root and Brook, that broke so many records, right? It's the fourth largest partnership ever for any wicket. It's the largest fourth wicket partnership ever in the history of Test cricket. It is the largest partnership for England ever and the largest partnership that Pakistan have conceded also, right? Conrad Hunt and Sobers, I believe, had that one, which is now a record broken. And if you think about it, it was a great Test match for Yorkshiremen. Shaan Masood got 150 and then Root got 262. Brook got 317. And if you really think about it, Root and Brook, if you combine their 262 and 317 in the first innings, they scored more, you know, amongst themselves than Pakistan did, all 11 players. That's more runs than 556, right? That I just find phenomenal. And I also think it's crazy how we're almost an hour into this podcast and we've even spoken about Crawley and Duckett, but Joe Root and Harry Brook haven't come up.
It was a bit boring for two sessions, just watching them score the easiest four and a half and over to negative fields and bowlers that weren't trying to get them out and fielders that were fed up and nobody in the crowd. Like, that's not a great watch, actually. Yeah. And the only record there that England didn't beat, which shows you what an outlier that guy was the Sehwag triple. You know, Sehwag's triple 100 was much faster than Harry Brooks. And Harry Brooks scored, what did he get, 100 off his last 60 balls or something? And Sehwag was just like, yeah, smack. When conditions were in his favour and his eye was on.
Both of those triples were in Multan. That is an important little factoid as well. Harry Brook, 317, of course, player of the match, deservedly so. The second player in history to score a triple 100 when you've scored your maiden double 100. And he even said in the post-match presser or something that he was just looking to, you know, beat his dad's high score, which was 210. And he goes on and becomes the sixth Englishman in the history of Test cricket to score a triple 100. And he loves it in Pakistan. He even said that, I want to roll up the pitch and take it back home with me, because he's played four Test matches over here. He's got 100 in each of them. In his last three innings in Pakistan, he's got 100. And now, well, the latest one is a triple. And no non-Pakistan batter has scored more tons in Pakistan than Harry Brook. Man has played in Pakistan in just six innings. Like, what the hell is going on over here, right? Like, he broke Sehwag's record, because Sehwag's 309 was the highest score in Multan. Now it's Harry Brook's 317. And in his career, he's batted in Pakistan in six innings. He's got 785 runs, compared to 21 innings in England, where he has 761 runs. So that also tells you a story. And Tim Neilson, Pakistan's high-performance coach, even said that Pakistan were afraid of bowling straight to him. He did a number on the opposition, and that was Harry Brook at his absolute best, because this kid has range. He has all the shots in the book. He can charge down the track and hit you for sixes. He has these weird tennis forehands as well that he like swat through like long off. And then he's got the drives. He's got the sweeps. He's got everything. He really like could be on his way to greatness if you think about it.
Yeah, he could. And I think players get rated by, this is going to sound daft, but bear with me. Players get rated on how good they are, but people don't break it down into formats enough. And actually, you would think that Harry Brook, because of all the shots he's got, would be a really good T20 player. But there are some guys that have all the shots, but their temperament, when you couple it with the technique, makes them Test match great. And he is potentially a Test match great. I don't rate him very highly as a T20 player. I haven't seen him play a lot. No one can doubt the talent, but he doesn't quite know how to construct the tempo of a T20 innings as those of us that watched all the IPL, where he got 100 and a load of failures. Obviously, he didn't play in it this time.
Well, he had a lot of good knocks versus Australia in the ODI series, right? Only caveat over here is that he didn't really play in India, of course, because of personal reasons, and our heart goes out to him. Even he was even looking up to the skies after scoring that triple. So, you know, that was a little cute little moment over there. And also someone in the comments has said that Sehwag's triple in Multan was slower than Brook. It was the one that he scored in Chennai that was quicker. Either way, he couldn't beat Sehwag, yeah. Right? But I still feel like, look, I honestly thought that England might just score 1,000 runs here and Harry Brook might overtake Lara. That looked very, very real at one point in the game.
NV Play's tools make cricket data accessible to everyone. They assisted me in making this and support many international cricketers access their software on their website for valuable insight.
Yeah, I think because England, this iteration of England really wants to win and force results, the 1,000 wasn't quite on, whereas only 5 or 6, maybe 10 years ago, they'd have gone, well, we've got a chance to break all records here, let's do that because it's going to be a draw anyway. And now England don't think like that at all. Just going back to Harry Brook, it's staggering how much he's come on from the innings that he played. And why Pakistan didn't pick up on this, I don't know, against Sri Lanka, what, 2 weeks ago, when he batted for about 15 minutes and Sri Lanka just bowled sixth stump outside off. And Harry Brook got really fed up in that 15 minutes. And you could hear him on the stump mic saying, what am I supposed to do? They've got loads of fielders on the offside. They're bowling miles outside off. And he didn't know what to do. Mm. And he got fed up, angry, and he smashed one straight to cover and got out in about, I think he was like 10 off 25 or something. Why weren't Pakistan, rather than bowling on his legs where he was just tucking it into the leg side and getting one or two for like a day, why didn't they do that? Why didn't they do that tactic that got him out one test match ago? Like, we all saw it. It was on the telly. Yeah. Like, they had pictures. Why didn't Pakistan do that for an hour? Bowl six stump, wider and wider, at risk the wide on the offside, pack the offside, try and frustrate the guy. Instead, they just went, we don't want you to hit us for six. That's our job. It's a test match, right? Test match. Yeah. It's meant to be a test. That's what the bloody name of it is. Don't just let the guy score one every single ball if he wants it. All Pakistan did was they said, Harry, you're brilliant. We think you're great. We definitely don't want you to hit us back over our head for six. So we're going to give you one every ball. Please take it. Not what Sri Lanka did. And Sri Lanka are not world beaters in test match cricket. And away in England, they managed to find a way to win a test match by just bowling wide outside and using their brains to frustrate somebody with that level of talent. Why Pakistan didn't do that, I don't know.
I mean, there was no tactical nous, really. Strategies just seemed to fall flat. And Pakistan just, you know, like you said, or I said earlier, I can't even remember, that we could outthink this Pakistan team, right? And you're watching them play and, you know, I'm really impartial now when I'm watching cricket. I don't really care who wins or loses, but it's just frustrating to see any team do that. Like, you're talking about taking 20 wickets and then you're bowling like outside their legs and it's easy for them to just sweep along the ground. That's what they were doing. They weren't even going for the expansive slog sweeps. They were just literally getting those singles. You're kind of playing into the opposition's hands. And to your point, they could have tried that, bowl outside off stump and try to frustrate him. They didn't. He scored 317. And then, of course, you've got Joe Root. It would be unfair to end this podcast without talking about him, right? 262, which was phenomenal. It's his highest test score in his more than a decade-long career, right? And he overtook Alistair Cook as England's highest ever run scorer in test cricket. And as a result, Joe Root is now the fifth highest run scorer in the history of test cricket. He also completed 20,000 international runs for England during this test match. 35 tons now for him in tests. And till the end of 2020, that number was just 17. Since then, you know, 2021 onwards, Root has 18 tons. And the combination of Smith, Kohli and Kane Williamson have 17. So he has more tons than all of those guys, which I just find to be a ridiculous statistic, right? His first ton in Pakistan, obviously weirdly missed out in the last tour. Everyone got runs, but Root didn't. And his second versus Pakistan overall, funny stat that every time he scores 100 versus Pakistan, he gets to 250 plus, right? And he's only had two 250 plus scores. It's like the Ollie Pope one. He averages, what, 85 once he crosses 30? It's something like that, right? He's also feast and famine, as you mentioned earlier. But, you know, sure, we all know what a class player he is. And I think he is undoubtedly the greatest test batter in contemporary cricket. Like, there's Root, there's Daylight, and then there's other people. I firmly believe it to be that way. But what you really have to laud over here is his fitness. Insane fitness. Barely ever missed a test for England. I think he's missed like one test match, right? And then he was in early, of course, batting at number three because Duckett had injured his thumb and Pope was opening and he was gone on his second delivery. So Root was out there fielding for 149 overs. And I think he batted for 136 overs, which comes out to like, I don't even know, man, 280 odd overs. and then you could see his undies and his trousers and shirt kind of like, you know, get drying up on the field in the Multan sun. He's 3,250 runs away from Sachin, and that number was 4,000 or something not too long ago.
Yeah.
I think he should come and play in Pakistan every year. He'll get there. He'll overtake Sachin that way. But what a cricketer. And the best thing about Bazball 2.0 is that Root has gone back to his old template. Everyone is batting around him in the, you know, Bazball fashion. But Joe Root is taking his time and he's just ensuring that he scores bulk runs. And I personally love that.
Yeah, well, he is now. In the last Ashes, one of the days, he came out and he tried to reverse. No, what did he do? The kind of pick up scoop for six off the first ball of the day in a test match against Pat Cummins, wasn't it? And you think that version of Joe Root can't catch Sachin because every time he scores 100, he's going to get out next ball playing left-handed or whatever. Yeah. This one, like I said earlier, he showed us a glimpse that he might be doing that, but he actually went okay. I remember being at his, I think he got about 180 at Lord's. I was there. And the reason why he didn't score 200 that day is because he started doing ramps and scoops. And whilst Root has proven that he can come along with the Bazball whacking and play more inventive shots and stuff, the guy that just bats how he wants to bat, he's mastered the tempo of test match batting because he doesn't get stuck. He doesn't do that bit where he's like, he hasn't scored for 25 balls or whatever, which can happen to anybody. He just keeps nudging it about, rotating strike. If you bowl him a bad ball, he fences it. He's not whacking it everywhere. He's not reversing stuff. He doesn't do the Ben Stokes innings where he might score 100 off 100 balls, but he didn't score off the first 40 of them or whatever. He doesn't do that route. He just ticks along in third gear and you can't get him out when he's seeing it. He's the best player of spin I've seen for England. When he's in, and he also, like, going back 4 years when he got panned a lot over here for not converting, right? That was the thing. He wasn't
that
converting.
That was the
enough.
Conversation when people would like rank the Fab Four. They'd be like, oh, but Root's conversion rate is shit. I remember Akash Chopra was like, kick him out of the Fab Four. He's not Fab Four material. And now he is right at the top of Fab Four, right? And I mean, this is a guy who basically plays every test match. And sure, England get a lot of stick that they, you know, they play a lot. But he's good for all of those test matches, right? And like you said, he is the best player of spin for England that you've ever seen. In my lifetime, he's the best batter for England that I've seen, right? I haven't seen W.G. Grace and Jack Hobbs because those are probably, and Len Hutton. Those are the guys who'd probably like challenge Root, right? I haven't seen them bat. So I would say that at least from the batters that I've seen, Root is the best. And he's got a shot at overtaking Mohammad Yusuf again, Moyo, for the most runs in a calendar year because he's close to like 1,200 now and he's still inked in to play like five more test matches this year, right? Or is it like four more test matches this year? And he could get there. He could overtake Moyo in this series alone, get a triple in the next game, a double in the last one. Who knows? Because he's just in this purplest of patches, right? We've barely ever seen anything like this, that someone just goes on a tear for 4 years. That's what it is right now. And it's insane how he has just, you know, for a large chunk of this, Bazballed as well. That didn't impact him. Even when he was, you know, struggling as captain, he was still scoring runs. He was a bit of a one-man show. He is inevitable. You just cannot get Joe Root out early these days.
No, I think he's cracked it with the conversion thing. Once whatever he did, whether that was just a mental thing or he had to reset himself or whatever it was, he's cracked it. But the thing England need to be wary of here is relying too much on him. And I think this is what we're seeing from Pakistan. They rely too much on Babar. And when Babar folds, the whole lot of them do. And when Root failed against Sri Lanka in the one test he did fail, England lost.
Yeah.
And that's because as good as Duckett and Crawley are at setting the tempo for England, how England want to bat, and they're both brilliant, and Duckett is the most improved player against spin I've ever seen.
Absolutely.
Because when he burst onto the scene against Bangladesh, he got bowled for five runs every innings, basically.
Like, and
he
now such he's got
flaw.
All four types of sweeps, right?
Yeah,
that's
exactly
what he is.
That. Exactly that. But he gets out for 80 a lot. And some, you know, people would say that's a great problem to have, but he hasn't worked out that hunger or the discipline or whatever it is to get the big ones, which Root has. And so Crawley has a severe problem in the 70s, right? That's like his kryptonite. If his score starts with a 7, just back unders, because he can't get to 80 when he's got 70. I think he's failed to get to 80 more times than he hasn't when he's got 70. Do you know what I mean? He's that bad in the 70s. And that's a mental thing of not being able to kick on. Sure, both of those guys play in a very attacking way, so they're going to give chances or whatever. But Sehwag played like them. Yeah. And he was able to get the triples and bat all day long when the pitch was good.
And
those
doubles.
Two guys.
He has a lot
and
of
the doubles.
As
yeah,
well.
Yeah, 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 for yeah. sure. The monster scores. So England's. So those two guys need to mature a bit. Root won't be around forever. He's only 33, Joe Root, though. He feels like he's been around forever.
Almost 34. So I feel like if his form doesn't dip, maybe we're looking at 5 years from now, where he could potentially overtake Sachin. I know it's going to be, you know, quite a difficult task because, of course, everyone's form dips. He can't just continue to go on like this forever. But one thing that I absolutely loved about him was that he could have retired hurt, right? He was cramping a lot. You could see him literally wince in pain, drink that pickle juice. He stuck it out over there. And he was cramping when he was like on 100-something. He ended up with 262. So that goes on to tell you what a thorough professional he is. And he is really hungry for those runs right now. And I feel like if anyone can, Root can, right? Because no one else can get close to Sachin's tally.
He can do it. We were discussing this earlier. He can do it. He probably needs to stay injury-free.
Yeah.
Or he can't have a bad one anyway. He can't miss a year. And
his
he needs
motivation.
To stay hungry.
Yeah, his motivation
because
is important.
Alistair Cook was only about Root's age now when he packed it in. Yep. And I was one of the staunchest advocates of him carrying on because England didn't have an opener to replace him at the time. He was just like, and bear in mind, that's a guy that doesn't play any other formats, never played any franchise stuff, Alistair Cook. It was like, if you want Alistair, you can just be on your farm all the time and just play the 30 days of test match cricket a year that we want you to.
Yeah.
And you can do whatever else you like. And he went, do you know what? I've got a load of runs. I've done it enough times. I don't have the hunger for it anymore. I'm going to stop. I'll play a bit for Essex and see you later, everybody. And that is a thing that's very difficult for us on the outside to know what it really is like to be away all the time, as Root is. And he's done the captaincy thing. It was a great idea that he wasn't the captain anymore because he wasn't a very good captain. He didn't win any matches with captaincy. And Stokes, whatever you want to say about him, is an excellent captain. He's really forward-thinking. He plucks results from nowhere and all that sort of stuff.
Manufactures wickets. Manufactures a lot of wickets, right?
Absolutely. And good on him for that. And that wasn't Root's job. Like, he wasn't good at doing that job. So they took it off him, which is really, really clever.
Yeah.
Maybe he shouldn't have done it in the first place, but it's a rite of passage if you're the best batsman for most teams is you're going to be the captain, aren't you?
I mean, that's what happened with Babar in Pakistan, right? He wasn't, the perfect candidate, but he got that job because he was the best batter. We need to discuss one more thing. I know this has gone way over time, Rob, but there's just been so much conversation and a lot of these things weren't even on my notes that have just like kind of sprung up to mind. But Pakistan's bowling has to be spoken of because they took 7 wickets in 150 innings. And even if the pitch is flat, that does not make for good reading or not doesn't make for decent or, substandard reading. It's bad. And like we said, Jack Leach took 7 wickets in the game. So they couldn't even out bowl him, let alone England. And in the last 11 test matches that Pakistan have played at home, in which they haven't been able to win, right? Their winless streak of 11 tests at home. They've managed 135 wickets, which is just over 12 wickets per game. Now, in this particular game, 6 bowlers conceded more than 100 runs, which is also a record. They've leveled Zimbabwe. And sure, Amir Jamal, you can say, bowled his heart out. Naseem was unlucky, maybe a touch. And Shaheen only looked good in that first spell, the first 4 overs he bowled. He didn't really look good after. Abrar, negative lines, as we've discussed. And he looked quite bad as well, and then broke down. Pakistan do not have a spinner, right? We don't even know who's going to replace him. It could be Noman Ali, who's also been abject, apart from like the odd innings. And then Zafar Gohar was very recently playing for Gloucester. And I don't know if he's actually even in the reckoning, because I don't think he wants to play for Pakistan anymore. Then you've got basically no one. Zahid Mahmood, Mehran Mumtaz, these guys, you're going to push them into the deep end and we don't even know what's going to happen. The paces would inevitably break down, right? If you continue to curate these sort of surfaces. And you're playing with a Kookaburra, maybe you could use a Dukes in the future. I don't know. The domestic circuit is using the Dukes ball, so maybe that could be something. Pakistan are on the brink of irrelevancy. There is no doubt about that. And they haven't been even through their exile years, right? They remained resilient. They even rose to number one for like 5 minutes. And if you can't take 20 wickets in a test match, and even attempt to take 20 wickets in a test match, then you won't win anything, right? That's how you win tests, unless there is a fancy declaration. Their bowling is at the heart of their steep decline, even if the batting has been terrible, even if they've been collapsing in the third innings. Maybe they could have saved a few tests over there, but they can't win any of those without the bowling. And on paper, they don't look bad, but this is like, this is the numbers that I've read out to you. They're as abject as it gets, really. So do you have any like hopes of seeing this? Like, not hopes, but can you even see them fix this in the remaining two tests? Because I can't.
Well, they need some help from the pitch, I think. So you named some people there who could play as the spinner for Pakistan. And whilst that cupboard, compared to the Pakistan bowling cupboards of the past, is bare,
yeah,
it's not as bad as England, right? All of those guys that you mentioned are better than Bashir, and some of them can field and some of them can bat, and Bashir can't do either of those two things, right?
I mean, you're being a bit unfair to Bash. Sure, he bowls a lot of rubbish in between, but that delivery to South Shaquille was pretty good.
Yeah, okay. okay, if you like, but Bashir... We're not here to bash Bashir, are we? We're here to talk about the Pakistan bowling. On paper, Pakistan's bowling attack is better than England's in that first test match, right? You would rather have Nasim than Gus Atkinson. You'd rather have Shaheen than Wokes. And you'd probably rather have Abra than Bashir, certainly. Like, I don't think it's the problem is the actual personnel there. What they've now done with a test match just about to happen at the same place in a couple of days, is they've knackered the quicks by making Nasim carry on bowling when England were past 800. They made their young, injury-prone quicks carry on bowling in blazing heat. So that is mental.
Yep.
Anybody could have been bowling then. So we talked about that. So what they now have is the same people, but much tireder, because they were tactically inept. They also didn't give themselves chances to take wickets because they decided that they weren't going to win the game. So whether it was a toys out the pram, you know, spitting the dummy out, any baby analogy you want, they kind of gave up in that test match. And they bowled negative crap, which spoiled the game as a spectacle. And we're talking about here one of the most incredible test match results, statistically anyway, of all time.
Absolutely.
And Pakistan tried to make it really boring. Like, how have they managed to do that?
Managed to score 556 runs in the first innings and they nearly lost the game on day four, right?
Yeah, they've lost by an innings and 50 and they scored... I mean, even their second innings... Like, how many third innings of test matches are 200-plus smacked along at four and over? Like, on paper, like, it all sounds okay, but the fact that bowling attack, I think the reason why England performed much better with the ball is because they tried to get wickets, and it's not that they're more skillful, those bowlers that I've just mentioned, I'm not going to go through them all again, they're not more skillful than the Pakistan bowlers, but they set fields that were attacking, they had plans, they thought about it. Even Ollie Pope, right, who is not a good captain, was doing stuff. He was like, right, we've done an hour of this, it's back to Leach. And he even did it on the last day. He didn't bowl Leach straight away. He went, let's give him some bouncers first. Let's have the enforcer, which was Cass. Let's have him bombing them for a bit. Now they've settled into that. Here's Jack Leach, wicket, third ball. Like, I think he got a wicket at the first over of his spell two or three times in that test. Because England were thinking. And again, like, England aren't the cleverest team ever. English people aren't particularly clever. Let me tell you that, like, living here all my life. Don't get outthought by England. Australia realised that when they came over for the Ashes. Like, England were dumb. England threw that series away. They should have won that series. They did loads of stupid stuff. So it's not like you're playing against a load of geniuses when you're playing England. It's just that Pakistan didn't really try. They didn't think enough. They didn't try and win. They didn't have any plans.
Yep.
So they made their bowlers look crap. And maybe yes. they're not. So they need to turn up in the next one, which is just around the corner. They're going to be faced with very similar conditions and similar problems, and they need to do a better job of solving them, is what it is.
Let's see. I mean, I'm going to Multan for the second test match. And
nice.
I don't want to fall asleep in the press box. So hopefully there's a better surface on offer. And like, Pakistan have their backs against the wall. And this is not the mercurial team of old. Like I said, they're consistently poor. And the bottom line really is that Pakistan are bad right now. Like, they just are not playing good cricket. And as you mentioned, tactically, they are worse than, I don't know, man, a turtle. A turtle would be better at this job. Anyway, that kind of wraps up all of our talking points. So, Varun, my man, give us the super chats. Let's take those quickly and wrap this up. We've got Sharon Vinakota up front, asks or says, Behram, admirer of your work. Thank you, Sharon. Explain to me the mockery of the PCB right now. They have appointed Aleem Dar selector, and as selector, what can he do? So, Sharon, I don't think we've ever seen a former umpire being appointed as a selector in cricket before, and this is as PCB as PCB gets. I don't really know what to tell you. So I don't think you need to have a cricketer per se as a selector. If someone has done the necessary courses and understands cricket, they can do the job as well. But is Aleem Dar that guy? I don't think so. I don't know, honestly. So it sounds really stupid to me. Rob, you want to add anything to that?
I mean, I don't really like answering questions like this, but I don't know is my answer. Like, I don't think he would be good at it, but he has watched a hell of a lot of cricket.
Yeah.
Like, there's no doubt about that. Maybe he'll be good. I mean, there comes a point where kind of everybody gets to go at being Pakistan selector. It'll be us two one day. Like, everyone gets their 10 minutes being a Pakistan selector. So maybe he'll unearth someone. You know, why not? Why not give him a go?
Yeah. He's retiring from his umpire career and now he's going to be a selector. Like, time will tell. But on the surface level, it seems kind of stupid to me. Anyway, next super chat, please, Varun. We've got Aditya Mani Jha says, Hi, Robin Behram. Hello to you, Aditya. What's your preferred five-man attack for this Multan pitch? All currently active test bowlers around the world are eligible. Whoa. Okay, Bumrah's in there, right? So we put him there. It didn't turn much, but we still need some tweakers. I'd say Jadeja, because he gives us a bit of batting.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe Pat Cummins?
Cummins is second best seamer in the world for me.
Yeah, so he'll keep bowling top of off.
Do you know who I would pick for this Multan pitch? It's James Anderson, and I'd pick him now.
Well, he is not active, so he can't count. So you've got Bumrah and Cummins. Let's say Cummins bowls first change. We need one more new ball bowler. Let's go express pace, right? Throw in Mark Wood over there. Why not? But he's also first change. So Cummins is taking the new ball now with Bumrah, and Mark Wood is coming first change. You've got Jadeja, and you know what? I don't know, man. Ashwin over Lyon, right?
I think just about, if batting counts, then obviously Ashwin wins there. And the fact that Ashwin and Jadeja play together all the time.
Yep.
I think I would probably want some kind of mystery or somebody that can occasionally be unbelievable. I don't know whether you can talk enough about Afghanistan players when it comes to test match cricket on these sort of pitches as well, because as good as Rashid Khan is, how many times has he won a test match on a road? Like, he hasn't really got that experience. So maybe not him, but I would want somebody that does a bit, you know, maybe Kuldeep rather than Ashwin on this particular deck, because you've got to do something different with the ball. I don't think any other Englishmen are in the conversation now.
I mean, I think from what we could have gone Nokia over Wood, but I think Nokia isn't active either anymore. I don't think he's going
to play.
No,
he slowed down way too much.
So, yeah, Bumrah, Wood, Pat Cummins, Ashwin and Jadeja. I think we have consensus here.
Cool.
Yeah, you guys let us know in the comment section below what you would play, right, as an ideal five-man bowling attack in Multan. Let's go to the next super chat, Varun. We've got Agro Kopite. Says, with the increase in coverage of IPL retention among Indian media and cricketers like Ashwin just days before the New Zealand Test Series, where would you see the relevance of Indian bilaterals, especially once Rohit and Kohli retire? Test cricket bilaterals will always have context. I think Indian or not, all are limited overs bilaterals are just like, no one fucking cares, man.
Yeah, Very true. Like, unfortunately, we were talking the other day about how good the Tri Series used to be in ODI cricket. Mm. When you get like the Commonwealth Bank Series or the whatever beer was on sale in Australia at the time, like those ones were great when they had three proper teams going at each other, and then they would have like a three match final. They were brilliant, those sort of things. And they've gone now. Like, money has spoiled everything. Franchise cricket has put too much of a strain on the calendar for bilaterals in limited overs to have any kind of contest, because what teams are using them for now is to experiment. Like, England played Australia in an ODI series recently. Mm. And for all of my cricket watching life, that is something that I would always look forward to.
Yeah.
And I couldn't care less. I can't even remember what the bloody score was now. Was it a draw and then it rained or something? No one cares.
Yeah, because I think Australia nicked it in the last game on DLS. But again, I didn't really watch that series, right?
Yeah.
And I didn't really care about it.
Well, when Australia are turning up and they're going, right, we're resting Hazelwood, Stark, Zampa and Cummins. Okay, then what are you not? It's not Australia then, is it? And England are going, oh, well, this guy can't play because he's tired and we're saving this guy. And Gus Atkinson's done too much, like, in the test matches, so he's not playing either. Like, bilateral series, unless you're in the year of the ODI World Cup for ODIs, mean nothing, which is a real shame now. I don't think Virat and Rohit retiring has much of a, you know, is going to make a huge impact on that. It's if somehow the universe aligns properly again and we stop having so many pointless franchise cricket matches, then maybe they get a bit more relevance. But the relevance of those things has gone now.
Yeah, at least for me, it's dead. But test cricket, you know, whoever plays it, you always care. So there is a bit of that. And maybe the World Test Championship has a role to play in that as well. But yeah, I mean, even when India is playing bilaterals, I don't really care much about that either. Even when Pakistan is playing, like, it's just like, who cares who wins those or loses those, and full-strength teams are barely playing. Only Pakistan actually does play their full-strength team, even if they play Nepal, right? Shaheen Haris Rauf and Naseem Shah will be playing against Nepal at home. Anyway, let's go to this next super chat, Varun. Kachua Chop says, Pakistani cricket is that middle-aged man, well, I would argue it's an old man now, who made so many mistakes in their youth that they lack the motivation to work on any of them despite knowing how. So you just let life happen and take what you get. I don't know about that, man. I think Pakistan cricket was a really talented young man and then grew up to be a even more so talented middle-aged man, but reckless, right? And not consistent. So on their day, that middle-aged man could be the best in the world, but not consistently. And now that middle-aged man has gotten old, and whilst we live in a world where he could get a bionic arm or, you know, a pacemaker and stuff which could keep him alive longer, he willingly chooses to not get those treatments or whatever. I think that's where we're at, because cricket is evolving and Pakistan cricket is not. And you can blame a lot of things, like blame this on a lot of things. I think we mentioned them earlier in the podcast. I don't have the energy to repeat them right now, Kachua. So we're going to go forward. Last super chat of the day, we've got Shlok Ankit or Ankit. He says, Pakistan has spread corruption to the level of their cricket. Who on earth couldn't have predicted that Shaheen, Naseem and Abrar would be thrashed in Multan? I mean, thanks for the money, Shlok, but that's a serious allegation. So I'll just leave it at that. All
right.
No comment. Yeah, no comment on that. Anyway, thank you to everyone in the comment section. Thank you for the super chats. And thank you, Rob, for making it to the show. I said it'll be around 45 minutes and we've been talking for an hour and a half.
You lied. You lied to me, Behram.
Yeah, well, both of us clearly had a lot to say, and I hope everyone enjoyed. Of course, just a quick reminder to everybody, you can go to goodareas.co and bookmark that webpage. That can prove to be your one-stop shop to all the work that we do as part of our team at Good Areas, whether it be written content, you've got podcasts and videos. Everything is there, so go watch some of that stuff, and we'll be back with another live show soon enough. Jared will be back from vacation. We'll try to get Rob anyway, time after time. And yeah, hope you guys enjoyed. Have a good one, and we'll see you soon enough. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast. So support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.